When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, we have got on another brilliant guest, and this is Daniel Kapadia, aka DDK. He is big in the world of esports. He's a commentator, a gamer, and we're going to be talking about a whole bunch of stuff today. So welcome to the show, Daniel. How are you doing?
Thanks. I'm doing well. Didn't expect this to happen. Obviously, you set it up just yesterday, but really happy to be able to have a conversation with you. I think it should be a lot of fun.
Awesome, man. So, Daniel, for people who are not familiar with who you are and what you do, please tell them a little bit about yourself.
Okay. So, British living in the States. I have been in the esports industry before, I suppose you'd even call it esports, essentially. Competitive video gaming for maybe 20 plus years. And it kind of saved my life in many respects when I was very young and became my passion. And I found a lot of meaning through it. And so I've stuck with the industry, and I've worn a lot of hats for 10 years. I was broadcast talent, and I recently, within the last year, changed my role. And now I'm the general manager for a professional team with one of the biggest brands in North America called 100 Thieves. And I run one of their esports programs, so their Valorant program, which Valorant is one of the the newer esports, but it's quickly becoming the biggest in the world. And so you can kind of think of it. If you've seen Moneyball, I'm basically doing the role that Brad Pitt did in that movie. The general manager is responsible for essentially making sure that the program is successful on the long term. So the team is winning, and you'll get, you know, a budget allocated, and you get to do with it as you will.
Awesome, man. Well, I'm sure some of my listeners are going to be confused by the term esports. Some people will know what that is. Other people are going to be like, what's he even talking about? So explain what esports is to those who are not familiar.
Okay, yeah. Esports is basically just a term we use for competitive video games. So it's like if you think of, let's say, it's funny because we have a term in esports called traditional sports, which you don't use in traditional sports because it's sports, right? You know, it's sports. But in sports, you know, you'll have, you know, tennis, football, you know, rugby. There's like, you know, lots of different types of sports. And esports is basically just a catch-all kind of umbrella term for video games that are played competitively. And I suppose there's some degree of play with the term in the sense of, you know, what kind of classifies an esport. But I think for simplicity's sake, a game that has, you know, leagues, people play competitively, and they're looking to play professionally so they can maybe earn money through playing that video game, is sort of what's considered loosely an esport.
Mm-hmm. And you said you've been doing this for over 20 years, and, you know, I can see you. You're a young man. So talk me through a little bit of the story that led you from, I assume, just playing games as a hobby as a kid to doing what you're next. To doing what you're doing now, but like, walk us through that.
Yeah, so I was always a very competitive person, so naturally gravitated towards sports from a very young age, or anything competitive really. I felt a great affinity for it, but due to, I think, just not the best upbringing, lots of kind of strife within the family and so on and so forth, divorce and moving around, I was kind of very displaced, and the only thing I really had to kind of work with beside my love for video games was an internet connection. I would try to play sports, you know, in these various places I would find myself, you know, moving around, but it was kind of very disconnected because, again, when you go from place to place, you can't really stay with a team. You can't even necessarily stay with a sport. And the things I wanted to do sports-wise weren't really available. So had a computer, had an internet connection, and you know, did also love video games and found that you could actually play competitively in certain video games. And the first one that I played was a really old game called Quake 3, and that was the game I eventually ended up becoming a professional at, and one of the best players in Europe, in the UK, and Europe. And then, you know, I eventually in 2005 managed to get onto contracted to a team. But back then, you know, most players weren't really salaried by the professional teams. You'd get sent to events, but sometimes maybe that, you know, your team would be responsible for paying your hotel and everything for you to compete. And you know, maybe, you know, you would actually have to pay that cost. So, you know, you'd have to pay to compete essentially, which was for something that, you know, didn't make you any money, was pretty challenging back then. So, but that's kind of, you know, how things started for me. And the other thing that was a limitation too is that these tournaments, the competitive scene was very heavily driven by sponsor money. And from endemic brands. So let's say brands like, you know, Intel, for example, you know, they make processors. So it makes sense for them to sponsor a tournament for a video game that gets to kind of act as a marketing tool for their product. Mm-hmm. The thing is that doesn't really create a sustainable, you know, market essentially, because, you know, the game after a couple of years looks kind of old and dated, and there's a new game that has fancier graphics. So we were, those of us that were really interested in playing competitively in the early to mid to even to the late 2000s, we had to have the flexibility to be able to switch games because, you know, we don't know where the money is going. And if we want to continue to take it seriously, then we would like to follow the money to some extent. So that created kind of an unstable environment. There were a couple games that that managed to be stable and have continued their legacy to this day. I think Counter-Strike is the biggest example of that. That has been around for 20 years, and it's not really been changed all that much.
I remember people playing that when I was in boarding school like 20 years ago.
Yeah. Have you played yourself?
I've never actually played Counter-Strike. No, I've never played Counter-Strike. I remember as a teenager, there were some kids in, I went to boarding school, and there were some boys in my school, particularly the Korean kids, who were really into Counter-Strike. I remember walking into, they used to play in the library, like the house library. So sometimes you'd go in there and there's just kind of cables running around the place and they're on their laptop and they're all eating their noodles and just like cussing at each other in Korean. And you sort of walk into this thing and sort of like, whoa, what is going on here? But I used to play a lot of video games when I was a kid. I never played Counter-Strike, but you know, first console I remember was the Atari 2600. I'm dating myself nice. Here. Followed by the Nintendo Entertainment System. Then we had the SNES. Stuck with Nintendo for a while. N64, GameCube, and then I'm going through all the consoles I've had. I've had an Xbox 360, an Xbox One, and a Nintendo Switch, and then some of the portables as well. Lots of the different Game Boy iterations. I remember getting the old school. I remember when we had the old school original Game Boy way back in the day. So I'm someone who I would describe as being interested in video games, and I actually know more about them than people would expect me to, but I'm not a gamer. Most weeks I don't play video games. I probably play video games like a few times a month. I'll get into something, and then if I'm traveling, I've got my Nintendo Switch with me, so sometimes I'll play that instead of watching a movie. But I'm very far from the world of you know, full-blown competitive gaming, so I'm quite intrigued by it because it's one of those things that I get to some level. I probably get more than most people get, but I'm not like all the way there. I'm still kind of like, this is weird. So I'm intrigued to talk to someone who's like very much embedded in that world and has been doing this for a while.
Yes, it's so funny because you know, we'll probably talk a little bit about Twitch at some point, but when Twitch came along, for those of you that know what it is, you know, but for those that don't, it's a live streaming platform that was centralized around gaming culture. So you're watching people play video games, basically, and anyone can kind of make their own little TV channel where they're streaming their video, their gameplay, and you can just watch that and just hang out with them. And it's funny because a lot of people are like, oh, I don't understand this concept. Why would you watch somebody else play a video game? And I'm like, but you watch people play sports. It's the same thing. It's just entertainment. Mm-hmm. It's watching someone who's skilled at something or entertaining do a thing. And I think, especially with video games, I think one interesting distinction that I think you'll find quite interesting, and something that's been interesting for me too. I've listened to a lot of different podcasts, and I know that I've heard a lot of people who would maybe make the case that video games are a waste of time, in the sense that it's used for leisure singularly, and that you're not necessarily getting too much else out of it. Mm-hmm. And although that is true, it can be true, you can also, if you're playing something competitively, it can be a path for you to really hold the mirror to yourself, like any other competitive discipline, to see all of your weaknesses, and you're then driven through the path of needing to succeed to then come into, you know, encounter these obstacles of yourself, your own limitations, and learn and grow through them, which I think through the fire of competition, I think is pretty transformative for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And you can really, I think, like I did when I was young, achieve a lot of, what's the term, self-esteem. You know, you can earn something. It's like any other, like, competitive discipline. It is a meritocracy. There is no guesswork. If you won, it's because you were probably better, or hopefully it wasn't because you were cheating or something, but, you know, it's because you were better, and you earn those skills with your hard work and discipline. You get out what you put in, and I think that's really important. So video games can be a lot of different things. So, and I know that you're a very, you know, like, I'm wearing this shirt. It says progressive overload.
Okay, yeah.
So
the fable of the guy who carries the cow as it's growing every day.
Yes,
get stronger. I can't remember what's his name.
Milo.
Yes.
Of Croton.
That's the name.
I'll be honest. I actually made sure to look that up in case the shirt became a talking point. Just so I would remember it as well. So I think that journey and you know, mastery has been something for me that's always been extremely important as a guiding principle, and I found that through a lot of different types of video games. Like I said, I had to bounce around between various different types, and that's kind of that created a lot of very interesting learning opportunities for me, as I understood how to get really good at something, and then having the question, well, there's this other new thing, so the new video games, a different, maybe even a different genre, can I apply the same principles that I learned to get really good at this thing to get to the elite level at this other thing? And then I found out that there's a lot of very similar principles, and that was a pretty fulfilling journey for me.
Do you believe that children have the right to breathe mask-free or to go outside without the latest booster shots? What about the quote-unquote right to change their gender? Where do rights come from anyway? And why would you trust doctors to give you yours? Join the discussion this month at Unofficial Pediatrics, the Substack blog run by mainstream media's least favorite pediatrician, Dr. Adrian Gaty. Dr. Gaty was one of the first doctors in the USA to speak out against lockdowns, and he continues the fight for childhood innocence and well-being. If you are looking for a doctor who fears God more than he fears Fauci, then look to the second best four-letter word you'll hear today. It's not Zuby, it's Gaty. Check out his blog, Unofficial Pediatrics, at gaty.substack.com. That's gaty.substack.com. Subscribe today for free and join the battle as he challenges Big Pharma, Big Education, and a few more Goliaths along the way. One more time, that's gaty.substack.com. Now back to the podcast. Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it. What was the first video game that you really got into? So you said that Quake 3 was the one that you first started playing competitively, but I'm assuming/hoping as a kid you were not playing Quake 3. So what was the what were some of the original games that just got you into gaming as a whole, even not competitively?
Oh, that's interesting. I was always around computers from a young age. There's a lot of casual games. So when I was very, very young, I would watch my brother play just like point and click adventure games like Monkey Island, like all the LucasArts adventure games, if you're familiar with those, you know. Yeah.
Yes, dude. I miss them, Matt. Dude, those games were amazing. Those games were so good. I think it's such a shame that genre has dwindled, if not died. I know it hasn't died completely, but man, those point and click adventure games were the wave. I loved those as a kid.
There was actually a new Monkey Island that was released recently. I haven't played through it. I got to some of the opening scenes, and I'm worried that it was maybe a little too affected by, you know, wokeism.
Oh no!
I'm not sure because I've only played very like, you know, the first 30 minutes, but I'm a little bit worried that it might, you know, be, either way, it's probably still really funny, and I'll probably really enjoy it. But there are some good point and clicks, but they did disappear for a long time. You're right. There has been somewhat of a resurgence for some of the more retro type games like that. And you know, one of the original creators, like the two kind of geniuses, I guess, behind Monkey Island and the humor of a lot of the LucasArts adventure games was Ron Gilbert, who created the new one, and Tim Schafer, who then proceeded to, I think he's still working at Double Fine, and they've done a lot of really great games too. But yeah, so some of those games, Civilization was a great game. I learned the word Babylon when I was 3 years old, watching my brother play Civilization. So that was very educational. And what else? I mean, there's just lots of just random games on the Commodore. This is like, you know, a very long time ago. I was like three to 8 years old. But I really, really loved the point and click adventure games. Those are fantastic. Warcraft, the original Warcraft, the original Starcraft, these games in the 90s. And I did play Quake 3 when it came out. And that was the first major, I actually am so hooked to this. Like, wait, you're telling me I can play this other guy and I can beat him, and now I'm better than him, and then he has to try and beat me. I just love this, you know, it's a very basic concept, but I was just completely addicted to figuring out, okay, my brain was just suddenly working. What are all the little tactics and strategies and the approaches I can learn? How can I improve my mechanics in the game? And then that was just kind of, that was the end of it really at that point. I was like, I knew that was what I wanted to spend my time doing. Seems kind of sad, man. But it's worked out for me.
Yeah, dude. Props to you, man. I mean, look, I'll be real. My position on something like this is sort of like, look, if it's your, and this is not unique to video games, I think, look, if it's your career and you're making a living from it and you're enjoying it, or whatever, then it goes from being something that is potential, you know, hobbies are fine, right? Like, hobbies are all fine within moderation. I'd say there's a level of sort of time and energy spent on something where if you're going that deep and you're not getting a reward from it, then that's when I consider it a waste of time. Do you see what I mean? So if there's someone there who's not a competitive gamer and not a streamer by profession or not a commentator or whatever, and they're just sinking 6, 8, 10 hours a day into some video game that they're not building an audience from, they're not making any money from, they're not progressing, then I'm like, okay, that's a complete waste of time. By the way, I would say the same thing with obsessing over normal sports. I'd say the same thing about obsessing over politics. Like, if you're not a political commentator, you're not a politician, you're not, like, if you're spending 8 hours a day ranting and raving about what's going on with the, whether it's the Democrats and the Republicans or it's Tory and it's Labor or whatever, I'm like, bro, you're wasting, like, what's the point? You're just wasting your time and energy, which you could be spending actually progressing life in your career in some way. But my view on it is different, where it's like, okay, like, if that's what you do, so of course you're going to spend time on it and you're going to want to keep upskilling and getting better and being competitive and being creative. It's a different thing. But I think it's a foreign concept to a lot of people because it is new. You know, people are very familiar with the idea of sports, or what you guys would call traditional sports. It's been around for thousands of years. People are familiar with it. They get it. I would say, yeah, I mean, watching people doing things, you know, watching people who are great at a certain thing, there's a natural human appeal to that. And within moderation, you know, just being a fan, observing, whatever, that makes sense. But yeah, I think with everything, there's sort of levels. There's levels to it. But I think the esports phenomenon is very interesting because it sounds... it sounds weird. It's just kind of like, wait, that's new. Like, that's a thing, right? Like, when I've told people that there's esports stadiums, or even the term esports, I remember actually explaining it to my parents a couple of years back, and their minds were just blown, because when they think of video, when they think of video games, right, they just think of, like, oh yeah, those things, you know, our kids used to, you know, play those in the 90s and the thousands and whatever. But that's not something you can earn money from. That's not something you can build a stadium for and people are going to go and watch, or you can host a huge online tournament or whatever. But then at the same time, I'll catch even older people of the older generations on YouTube watching random cooking videos and random all sorts of random videos, and I'm like, okay, well, it's not that different. Like, people like to watch people do things that they are interested in.
That's so true. That's so true. Yeah. It's such a human thing. It's so interesting too, just the breadth of human interest and just how far people go. I think, you know, Richard Feynman was famous for I think it was Richard Feynman who said, you know, if you look deeply enough at anything, it will become just impossibly fascinating. And it's just, you know, it's, that's not verbatim, but something to that extent. I think it's very true. I think everything in life can be extremely interesting if you go deep enough. And I think that's just so wonderful. And I think that's what YouTube is all about. It's like finding all those people who have essentially, their life is a PhD thesis of one specific thing that they really love, and it's given them a platform. Yeah. So that's really, really powerful. I think
another, yeah, sorry, oh, no, go ahead.
Well, the British politeness battle.
Okay, okay, let me trumpet. I was going to say that another thing with my view as well on lots of things like this is you don't need to understand everything, right? Like, there's going to be hobbies and interests and things that people collect and things that people do and whatever, which to other people, you know, some people quote unquote get it and other people just don't. And I'm quite comfortable with recognizing, okay, there's some things I get and there's some things I just, you know, I don't, or I get to a degree or whatever. I mean, the idea of sitting on YouTube and watching videos of people showing what they bought from the shop or showing like makeup tutorials or whatever, I'm like, bro, that's like mind numbing to me. But you know what? Yeah. I'm not the audience. I don't need to get it. There's other things that I'm into, right? I don't know, powerlifting, right? Bodybuilding. Whatever, there's things I'm interested in, which other people are like, dude, like, how is that even interesting? And so I just accept, okay, you know what? Some people collect expensive watches. Some people collect stamps. Some people are into pens. Some people do train spotting. Some people are bird watchers. Whatever, man. Like, let people, I came across the other day, actually, funnily, I say the other day, no, last year. Funnily enough, I was in Austin. I was in Austin, of all places. And I was walking through, I think it was Zilker Park. And I saw these guys doing, what do they call it? Sort of like the LARPing, like the live action role play stuff. I think they called it foam fighting, to be more specific. So, right, so they had these like weapons made of foam. And they're all dressed like medieval knights and whatever. And they have these like, so, and they're just there sort of like battling out there in the field. And I'm like, what on earth is going on there? So I'm not afraid of strangers. I talk to strangers all the time. So I was just, you know, walked up there. I was like, excuse me, guys. Like, what are you doing? Like, I'm genuinely curious. You know, what are you doing? They were explaining the mechanics of it to me and how you score points. And, you know, there's like, there's archers and there's this. And, the, you know, they can use magic and whatever. And I was like, this is the nerdiest thing I've ever encountered in my life. But you know what? I'm glad you're outside. I'm glad you're in the sun. I'm glad you know what I mean? Like, dude, if this is what it takes to build community, and especially after the last couple of years where people have been all isolated or whatever, I'm like, God bless you. You know, like, I'm not going to be hyper judgmental of that. I'm like, it's not for me. Like, I'm not going to show up next Saturday. But, yo, if it brings people together and it fosters community and it's active and it encourages people to get better or whatever, I'm like, cool. Like, I'm for it. I don't need to do everything. I don't need to participate in everything. But I think it's good.
it's funny because you remind me as well. Like, I used to say to my mom, like, hey, it could be worse. I could be doing drugs. You know,
yeah, right.
I thought that was like a really good, you know, counter argument, but obviously it's just a false alternative. But that's fine. That seemed to work for me. But it's true though. Like, it's interesting. It's just because stuff that we find stuff weird or we can't understand it to begin with, doesn't necessarily mean that there's you know, and it doesn't have to be value for us. It's not about us. So, and I think that's what's really, you know, interesting. Honestly, there's so many different ways I think we could go with the conversation, you know, because I know that you talk a lot about just, you know, the UK and sort of, you know, going to America and, you know, the travels and just the differences between the different places and how people think differently. And I think that's, you know, if I'm the reason why I'm bringing this up is because one of the big differences I noticed going between the UK and America was it really forced me to question a lot of assumptions. And the interesting thing there is that there are so many assumptions that we have and operate and are almost guiding principles that are kind of unchecked because they're just sort of implanted in us by just, you know, osmosis. You just live in the place and you pick up various assumptions. It's just, that's just how, you know, any kind of commune of any kind, you know, functions, you know, you all kind of move, you know, the same motion in many senses, socially. And, And, you know, there are some really deep underlying principles, you know, things that, for example, were a challenge for me to kind of get to grips with. And one of those things was actually the idea of altruism, right? Because altruism is, I think, very fundamental in European society. And it's you know, a utilitarian idea, you know, which is essentially got a lot to do with, you know, socialist thinking. And, you know, going over to America, you know, you have a much more individualist based way of thinking, you know, with a more, you know, capitalist society where you're more concerned with the idea of freedom and individual rights. And it's really interesting because the word freedom, right, in Europe is thrown around as a meme, almost propaganda against the way that Americans may choose to look at their own values. And I found that very interesting because generally speaking, as I, you know, spent more time in America, I realized there were more and more kind of assumptions that existed. And I recognized that there was more propaganda than I thought that there was that would color my expectation of what life was like in America versus what it was really like if you actually do live in America. And the reaction too of moving here and living here has been interesting in the sense that there's a lot of people that have spoken to me thinking that, oh, you're in Texas, everyone's around shooting guns and like, you know, killing each other. And it's like, or even in the States, I've seen that. You know, I go to California all the time, and I was in an Uber recently, and I was like, oh, you know, I've moved to Austin. I used to live in LA for a few years. I just moved to Austin. I've been here for a year. It's really awesome. I prefer it. And the guy's like, oh, it seems like the taxes are good, but like it seems way too dangerous, all the guns and stuff. And I'm like, it's very, very, very a perspective with this really lacking nuance there. But it's interesting because it's a perspective that is, I think, bred of just these assumptions that get kind of pushed into you. So you gotta be really wary. I feel like we have such a burden on every individual to be really wary of the things that come our way, ideas wise, and to what extent we actually question those ideas. It's pretty exhausting, I think, actually.
As a global nomad who's constantly on the road, I often find myself connecting to the internet in insecure locations like airports and hotels. Sometimes I want to access movies, streams, and other content that's only available in certain geographic locations. And at all times, I want to be able to browse the internet with peace of mind without anybody snooping on me. That's why whether I'm at home or on the road, I never go online without using ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is an app that reroutes your internet connection through their secure servers, so your internet service provider can't see the sites you visit. ExpressVPN also keeps all of your information secure by encrypting 100% of your data with the most powerful encryption available. It runs seamlessly in the background and is so easy to use. All you have to do is tap one button and you're protected. ExpressVPN is available on all your devices, including phones, computers, and even your smart TV, so there's no excuse for you not to be using it. Protect your online activity today with the VPN ranked number one by Business Insider. Visit my exclusive link at expressvpn.com/Zuby, and you can get an extra 3 months free on a one-year package. That's expressvpn.com/Zuby, expressvpn.com/Zuby to check out the offer and get an additional 3 months for free.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point. And I think the reason why it's interesting you use the word exhausting, and that's exactly what it is. And I think that's why most people in most things don't look that much below the surface, because the world is extremely complicated. And so we are always, there's a tendency to always simplify it, right? We're always simplifying. I mean, even the way your eyes and your ears work, we are sitting here having this conversation. When I look at the screen, if I'm looking at you, I'm looking at your face on my screen, everything else is out of focus now, right? Like you can only focus in certain ways. You literally can't have the whole room in focus at the same time. You can't be listening in and attuned to everything at the same time. And because the environment is so complex, I think our brains just simplify all the time and use all of these heuristics and pattern recognition and things like that. And there can be problems with that when that is applied, especially to human beings. Right? Because that's always the temptation. And I think this is where a lot of political polarization and socio-cultural problems and issues between human beings or between groups happen, because you're applying these heuristics and this sort of very low resolution worldview, us versus them, you know, black versus white, red versus blue, this versus that, in-group, out-group thinking, when you actually need to be way more nuanced and see things on a more individualistic level. And rather than just having all these assumptions and biases and presumptions, actually experiencing things, right? So you might have a view on even a certain country, a whole country, and maybe you've never been there, right? You've never been there, you haven't really met anyone from there, whatever, but you have this like really strong bias, which you sort of run everything through. On the flip side of what you were saying, of course, I'm sure you've met people in the States who think that if you go to London, you're going to get stabbed, right? And that they're afraid to go to London. People in London are afraid to go to the USA. Like you just see. And then I think also because obviously we're wired for survival. So it's well known that human beings are much more sensitive to negative things and potential threats than they are to the positive. If you post a video and you get 100 positive comments and you get one negative one, the one negative one stands out, right? It's the one that sticks out and the one that you want to react to and respond to. The media knows this. Of course, marketing and PR and advertising agencies know all of this. If it bleeds, it leads. And so I think every day you constantly, if you want to be a critical thinker and you want to sort of navigate this complex world in a better way, you do have to be willing to expend that brain effort to not just kind of go with the emotions and the presumptions all the time and be like, okay, I do have my biases. I do have the things that I believe, which aren't necessarily based on that much information. Let me put that in check and have some humility and actually sit there. It's one reason I love doing a podcast, right? Because I'm like, okay, even with esports, I have my own views on certain things. Like I'm not just there like, oh, it's stupid. It's a waste of time. These don't get like, that's not my position. And I do want to talk about this, but I do have certain concerns with some aspects of it, especially as it pertains to people's social well-being, as it pertains to men in general, in particular, just because it's such a male-dominated arena, as it pertains to physical health and mental well-being and stuff like that. So actually, let's go into that. So as someone who is very much in this world and who I can tell is, you know, you think about a lot of this stuff more than average. What do you think are some of the potential concerns or issues or problems that can come with the video gaming, I guess video gaming as a whole and perhaps esports in particular? What are some of the things that you see?
It's a really interesting question. I think there is nothing in life without trade-offs. I think there's always a cost to anything. And I think, I've personally experienced some of those costs myself. You know, initially, for me, I put so much time into the video game world that whilst I got the benefit of this self-esteem from earning these kind of skills, I then had, as you mentioned, the trade-off in initially physical fitness and also social skills. For me, in my story, I one day woke up and I think I was like 16 and I was like, I was about to swear there. I am fat. What the hell happened? I just woke up and just have this awareness. Suddenly I look horrendous. So I took it upon myself to kind of fix that. And I managed to do that really promptly, but there's many that don't. And that is a natural side effect. You know, you're way less active than otherwise you would be. So physical fitness is an issue, and that is increasingly an issue. And you're doing an activity which is maybe it shouldn't even be called an activity because you are so inactive essentially. And I don't know necessarily what the solution is per se for that. I'm a big believer in the sense that, or at least from what I've observed, generally with human behavior, it tends to go from one extreme to the other before kind of, you know, averaging out in the middle somewhere. And I think that with esports and video gaming and how it's grown, how ubiquitous it has become in the last decade, especially, I think it's becoming more normalized. And I think that it's becoming a part of, it's less the case that, you know, sure, you will always have the 20% maybe that are so into it that they're really not doing anything else and perhaps they are, you know, getting really into a very poor physical shape and will have poor health outcomes because of that. But I think that most people, the demographics widened to such an extent that most gamers I see these days aren't sort of the any kind of stereotype. It's, I think, you know, I use the word ubiquitous because in the culture it's become really accepted, and there's lots of different reasons for this. And it means that generally, from what I see now, like lots of professional players that come up, I see them as, you know, amazing young talents in their teen years, and they're very different to the ones like 10 years ago, because now it's more normal to play video games, but also to socialize. You're not as siloed into this kind of group of, oh, you know, I'm a nerd. I'm kind of associating with that kind of stereotype, and I'm not cool, and all of that. And so instead, it's the case that actually, no, there's girls that I know that also play video games. There's, you know, I'm socializing people on Discord and at school, and there's like other normal things that I'm kind of still a part of. So you don't get pushed away or isolated away, I think, as you may have found people would if they were really into video games in the past. So that's kind of changing. So that's kind of what I mean as we go from extreme to extreme. Now we're kind of getting into a middle ground. But again, it is not a very active thing to do. And the social aspects are, I think, the thing that concerns me the most, actually, because I think that it's extremely important, obviously, to human beings, and connection with human beings is absolutely essential. The physical fitness is something that you can always address at some point. But I think especially in the teen years, losing some of those social opportunities, whether it be through school because you don't spend as much time doing extracurriculars, or because you're just more, again, kind of siloed into an environment where you're just sitting at your PC and socializing just strictly through the PC, and that's your preferred method of socialization. That's fine and everything, but again, you're losing these very key skills, and you do get behind, and that is a very real thing. And that can create, I think, a lot of, it's a ripple effect there, I think, for your future relationships and your future development. And so I do wonder if it's the case that people get kind of stuck in, you know, earlier developmental phases and get kind of stuck there a little bit because of this. And I've noticed too that a lot of influencers and big streamers, these are people that become really popular, but they are serving a very immature audience. And so I've noticed that they themselves also get stuck developmentally and yes, are kind of still immature themselves as well. So there is definitely something to this. I feel like you're asking this question at an interesting time, because we're in the middle of it, really. I don't really know what it's going to look like when we get a few years down the line, and you know, maybe later on from that. I know that my generation of players is kind of a little bit all over the place. You know, people in my age kind of got aged out quite early on. So if you didn't get into the industry,
how old are you?
34.
Okay.
Yeah.
The same generation.
Awesome. How old are you?
Yeah, I'm 36.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So people around my age, you were either aged out and became, you know, you were forced to become more normal, I suppose, at the time is kind of how you probably look at it, you know, go to school and so on and so forth, or you kind of got into the industry and you've been sort of a pioneer of the industry in some respects, which is kind of more the position I'm in. And we've all had to kind of like figure things out over time, but I can see that the people that are coming up now are a bit more, a little bit less affected, I think, than people like myself. I've noticed that a lot of people like myself, a lot of them had, you know, reasons why they were spending a lot of time alone, you know, whether it was not having the best family background or whatever it was. But just going back to that old example, you know, when you're siloed into a group that is by nature more isolated, you generally don't integrate as well. Socially, and I think that does have a huge impact on happiness overall. And it's hard to solve that. Like when you miss some of these developmental phases, I feel it's very difficult to go back, especially if you've missed the school years and you were going to school and now maybe you're at university. I went to university and I was a complete idiot when it came to being like socialized. I had lots of issues. I couldn't look girls in the eyes when I was in my teens. I again, much like one day waking up and seeing that I'm just in horrendous shape and I can't, you know, see certain parts of my anatomy when I look down. I was also unable to like look at like just have a conversation with a girl, and I would like sweat profusely, and I was like, oh my god, this is a problem. I want to be able to socialize with women. What do I do? And so I was like, okay, well, I got really good at Quake, so how can I apply this approach to getting good with women? And so I ended up. It's funny because I ended up actually going, okay, I just need to like practice socializing. So I'd go out and I would just just cold open, you know, groups of people and then women and so on, and then just try to talk to people, because I recognized that's obviously like one area where I was lacking, and that did help massively. However, I was still definitely a weirdo, so I had to contend with that. And in university, I ended up dropping out, and I think a lot of it was because of the fact that I struggled so desperately to like connect socially with people, and I couldn't find any group or individuals I could really resonate with. So I ended up dropping out after a year and a half. So yeah, there's a lot of trade-offs, I think, and it's something that I don't think we fully understand just yet. There's a lot about video games that we don't understand just yet, in general, how it impacts people. And I think it's the same thing, like talking about the extremes. I think I'm actually concerned with the way that marijuana legislation will go in the US because of the same reason. I feel like there's lots of pros, but I feel like no one's looking at the clearly documented cons in the scientific literature which are pretty clear. And I feel like people will just ignore that information will be suppressed, maybe for reasons economically, but also because that's just how things tend to work. We go through through extremes.
Yeah, it's interesting. Did you say that you're finding that the younger generation of gamers is more sociable than our generation?
Yeah, I'm noticing that, but it's a little bit. It's because also the demographics are so widened now. It's just so much more normalized. So that's partly the reason. It's not just the people that are inherently inclined to more isolated activities. It's also people that are maybe very extroverted that wouldn't otherwise have done it 10 years ago, but now everyone's doing it. It's really fun. And they can jump in a Discord group. And I think the pandemic probably magnified this quite a lot.
Yeah.
The pandemic was pretty good for gaming.
Okay. It's actually really positive for me to hear that, because I would have suspected the opposite, because I'm very aware that something unique about our age demographic is we are the last generation, right? If you're in your, I'd say late 20s to, you know, late 20s and up, we're the last people who remember the world pre-internet, pre-smart, you know, when we were in our teenage years, everyone didn't have smartphones and social media wasn't what it was. We remember dial-up internet, remember the early days of the internet, all that. So we've had both. We've had an experience both, but sometimes I wonder if I'm talking to someone who's 20 years old, I'm like, man, you never existed in a world where all of this stuff didn't exist. You've had, as far as you remember, there's always been Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and YouTube and this and that and smartphones, everyone walking around with a computer in their pockets. And I have concerns for, you know, people, let's say 25 and younger on that front, because I'm just like, man, from that social perspective, as you said, because when it comes to technology, and this goes with everything, this isn't strictly limited to video games at all. I especially think this with smartphones and social media. I think that they're a great addition, but my concern happens when they become a replacement, right? So if you have your real world friends and your real world social skills and your ability to look people in the eye and to communicate and to talk and to exist in the real world and be fully socialized, and then also you're on social media or you're gaming or you're whatever, and that's just like additional, awesome, right? I have tons of friends that I've met through social media, probably way more than 99% of people. But I can also socialize in the real world and make friends in the real world, talk to strangers, whatever. You know, I've kind of got the full gamut of the social skills there. But what concerns me is when I have talked to people like this where, you know, they've never met their best friend in real life, or when people are dating someone who they've never met, or all their friends are online or in this video game, or they just know them by their avatars or whatever. I'm like, that worries me. That's when I'm like, wait, but what about like the real world? Like if you don't know how to socialize in the real world, then that's going to massively hold you back, because, you know, digital realm is cool and all, but we are human beings with bodies that exist in a physical 3D space. And I do have some concerns of, you know, this sort of dystopian future of people just sort of plugged in Ready Player One style, and they've just got their goggles on or whatever, and everyone's just fat, and, you know, they're just being fed through an IV or something, and I'm like, man, that's I don't want that for humanity.
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, my my perspective, you know, my sample size, my anecdotal evidence, it's limited. It's very limited. And it's also, you know, it could very well be the case too that the bar has changed for what seems like acceptable or, you know, good social skills. You know, it's much like, you know, in the pandemic, I believe that didn't they change the grade standards like massively? I mean, I know this happens over time in general, that it's easier to pass everything, but the bar gets moved basically. And I wonder if, you know, if that could be partially the case too. How normalized am I to some of these changes? I mean, that's the thing with human beings, you always have to ask the question of is, you know, it's like the frog in boiling water. Is it the frog in boiling water? You know, yes. just the temperature slowly changing and it doesn't realize it's boiling to death. And I think that is a very good analogy for...
By the way, I've heard that whole analogy is like false and that the frog actually jumps out if you actually do it.
Okay.
But yeah.
All right. Well, the point stands at least. Because I think it's a great descriptor of human psychology, just the adaptation. It's so fascinating that we are so incredible at adaptation, but it is actually also the thing that is our biggest enemy in many respects, that we adapt to so many things. Just for example, any early childhood trauma, you know, you create adaptations that then are amazing because it allows you to survive, but then you're like, oh, now I have to discard these deeply rooted issues that I have because of that. But I think ultimately, I think it's there are a lot of pluses to video games, much like the marijuana example. And I think that we will eventually catch up a little bit. And I think there's going to be, I think it's important that you have the right leaders in culture. I think culture is extremely important in any scale. And I think that with regards to, you know, let's say previously I mentioned the kinds of leaders of culture we have now, a lot of it is like these influencers and I think a lot of these influences have been made on these awful algorithms. You know, obviously, I say awful. It's not the algorithm's fault. It's obviously, nor is it conscious. I don't know why I'm like anthropomorphizing it exactly, but essentially, the way that we consume content is, I think, a pretty big issue because the people who are the most successful get elevated to a position of being leaders of culture, essentially, because they lead the trends, because they have the most following. And what I see is pretty low quality, and that's because what allows them to get to that point is low quality. Like the algorithms for content creation on various social media platforms and YouTube and so on generally tends to favor volume over quality. And so, you know, I often feel like most content sucks that I see, especially in my industry. And it's because, like, and I get it. It's because you can't make really great quality content if you're trying to pump out volume. So yes. Everyone is just used to consuming volume, and that's actually something that really concerns me. And it kind of ties back a little bit to why I love podcasts so much, because as the human civilization has gotten more and more advanced over time, it's somehow become harder and harder to have a conversation. And I think that's fascinating. And I think conversation is extremely important. And that's another thing that's been really, in terms of the video game industry, that's been a big problem for me, is that it's hard to have conversations like it has been in most industries because of, you know, the way things have been going politically and how that's been amplified through social media. And the fact that I had a moment the other day, Zuby, where I was like, because, you know, freedom of speech is, you know, often a, you know, especially with what's happened with Twitter and everything, it's a hot topic. It's weird that it's a hot topic for me, but I was like, you know, I'm going to post this amazing video of Hitchens talking about free speech, where he talks about the moral dilemma of, you know, the guy shouting fire in a crowded, you know, theater, and I was like, oh, I shouldn't post that because maybe it's controversial. And I'm like, hang on, I'm not posting the clip about freedom of speech because I'm worried. I'm like self-censoring. That's awful. Like, what's happening here? This is not good. And in my industry in particular, it's not like I'm in a position to really talk about what I think is good thinking, because that's all I care about. I don't care about what you think. I think what everyone thinks they should be able to freely express it, and it's theirs to freely express. They it's their individual right that they have the freedom to have the, you know, three thoughts. You know, I don't want to be controlling people's thoughts. That's an individual right. So I don't want to come between that. Nobody should. And I think that's the beauty of the human species, is the extreme diversity that we have in terms of how people think. And it goes back to the YouTube thing. If we tie that back in, imagine if someone was telling you precisely what you're supposed to be interested in or what was interesting. The whole point of why YouTube works, like we established, is because people get to decide what they're really interested in, not somebody else. And they get to explore it on their terms, and they get to find an audience if one exists. And again, you know, for us to be in a place where, for me, I don't feel comfortable talking about just good thinking anymore, because asking a question is now not okay. You know, that's pretty awful. So yeah, that's another place we could have taken the conversation. I know we're kind of
yeah,
low on time.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, because that's interesting, because it does seem that everything's been infected by the woke virus, and it does certainly seem, from what I see as an outsider, that the video game world, both from a competitive and a non-competitive standpoint, just the same with other forms of entertainment, there's this, I don't know if it's rising, but there's this degree of genuine intolerance for people who are asking too many questions, or maybe you're following the wrong person on Twitter, or this or that. I mean, I'm glad you're coming on this podcast, because I have had messages actually from people who are more deep in the video game community who are like, oh, you know, I got some, I retweeted one of your tweets, and you know, some people got mad at me for this or that. You know, I get those type of DMs, right? So I'm just like, man, that's kind of it's a weird concept to me as well, because I'm very much just like, man, like, people have freedom. People have liberty. Like, follow who you want to follow. Like what you want to like. Talk. You know, we can have debates about what are good ideas and what are bad ideas, or, you know, if certain lines are crossed, right? You know, people are, it's fair to criticize and challenge things and whatever. But for that to happen, you have to at least all agree that people are entitled to their thoughts and their beliefs. And if you want to change someone's position, or you think someone is in the wrong, I don't think the best way to do it is to, you know, ban them or deplatform them or fire them from their job or get all their sponsors to drop them. I think it's you have a conversation, right? You address things like adults, not like children, and also have this acceptance. Again, if you want to talk tolerance and diversity and all these buzzwords people like, you know, what are these things really supposed to mean, right? Tolerance doesn't mean that you agree with everyone's position on everything. It means you accept that people are going to have different beliefs and views and actions on things and opinions, but we can still get along. We can still be civil. Everyone still has the same rights, and, you know, should be treated the same and be treated fairly and so on. But that seems to be being lost. Although I do have an optimistic sense that the pendulum is coming back towards more moderation and more sanity. I think there have been certain excesses and overreaches that various individuals and companies and organizations have done, which have kind of just, you know, made people be like, whoa, okay, wait, like that's going way too far. And they're now getting a lot of backlash from that. So I do think, you know, it will moderate. There's a lot of new things going on. There's a lot of new technology, although the way that we're communicating and all this stuff, it's new. It's new. So I think there's going to be growing pains. There's going to be misses. There's going to be mistakes, both from individuals and from organizations, even from the big platforms themselves. You know, you talked about Elon taking over Twitter. I think that's a very positive thing. You can see a lot of people being reinstated and the Overton window sort of opening back up a little, and not having this creeping sense of, oh my gosh, like, if I say the wrong thing, am I just going to, one day my accounts are just gone? So I think there's a lot to be optimistic about.
Yeah, and there's one point I want to use around this to kind of tie in a little bit to some of the previous talks. You know, I mentioned progressive overload. We talked about like mastery. We talked about the competitive disciplines, the meritocracy. So we're like really talking about general concepts that as they relate to human growth. And I think most people resonate with the idea of growth. I think that's a very human quality, is to pursue growth in various forms. And generally speaking, growth is, you know, I learned this term from Rhonda Patrick. There's a term in biology called hormesis, which is there's a process that happens in the body that, you know, when your body is stressed by something, like eat some broccoli and there's like some little toxins in the broccoli or whatever, it creates some stress on your system, and then that creates an adaptation. And generally speaking, this is how our, you know, biology is designed. So basically everything human related is designed this way. You create the stress, or, you know, there's resistance that then forces an adaptation of some kind, which makes you stronger, which is growth. So your system is designed almost to be broken, to become stronger and to grow. And with regards to conversation, with regards to ideas, it's exactly the same thing. When you come across opposing ideas, or even ideas that are unfamiliar to you, you're experiencing their like resistance that you can, that's a challenge. That's like, you know, me playing, you know, a competitive game against somebody. They are, again, like I said earlier, like there's, you know, one way of saying it is that they are the mirror. You know, they're showing you your weaknesses or the things you don't understand or the things yet to be conquered, to then get over that hurdle, which is maybe what they represent in that competitive hierarchy. Or another way to put it as well, which is a bit more poetic, which is one thing I really like about competition, is that it is poetic. It is the fact that your greatest nemesis, perhaps the person that drives you to the most, just, you know, that has the biggest rivalry with you, that you can't beat or whatever it might be, is really your greatest friend. It's the person that is there showing you the path to your improvement. And it's so interesting, the duality there, that although, you know, you have all this ferocity against this person, there is actually a very compassionate relationship between you and them, that even though you're in competition, and I think fight sports are really cool when you see this, there is a level of respect that these competitors can only know between each other, because they are the only ones that understand what it took to get to that point in which they are at, the kind of trials and tribulations that they overcame to get to that point. And I think that is one of the most awesome human stories, that everybody has accessible to them is facing adversity and using it for growth.
Amen. I love that. Daniel, man, we could go for a long time, but I have to be cautious of the time. But where can people find and follow you online?
Yeah, so on Twitter, my handle is DDK Esports, and I also make some YouTube videos. I'm on Twitch. YouTube is 4K DDK, and Twitch is DDK TV. So if you want to follow me on any of those platforms, I tend to make a lot of content. And equally, if you want to follow what I'm doing with with the team that I'm running, 100 Thieves is the team that I'm working with. For those of you who don't know anything about esports, Drake is one of the owners. And yeah, if you follow them and you follow the Valorant program, you'll be able to see essentially what my team is doing. We're one of the best teams in the Americas region right now, in this hemisphere. So it's pretty exciting. We have a big tournament coming up in Sao Paulo in Brazil in mid-February. So if you want to start watching Valorant, you can follow 100 Thieves and I'll run in Brazil.
Awesome, man. Well, good luck with the competition, and thank you for sharing some real valuable insights, because I know with this podcast, I've got a really broad audience demographic, literally from teenagers to people in their 60s and 70s. And so I think you've done a fantastic job of explaining some of the, I think dispelling some of the misperceptions people may have about this entire world, while also acknowledging and explaining some of the concerns that you personally have and that exist wider. I think it's actually, you know, this technology is not going anywhere. People are into this. Millions of people are into this. And so I think it's important to have these conversations and understand how we can keep people mentally healthy, physically healthy, socially healthy, all through this, while still, of course, having maximum liberty and having people, you know, being able to enjoy the various things that they want to do.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
I appreciate you, Daniel. Thank you. I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.